Today's WBFO brief was recorded at around 8:30 in the morning. This is WBFO News.
So the use of so-called community responders in the city of Buffalo could save millions of dollars. Currently in use in over 100 locations around the country, health professionals and trained peers are tabbed to respond to 911 calls that are considered not violent or not criminal. Andrea O'Sullivan from the Partnership for the Public Good says a recent study shows 80% of 911 calls in the city of Buffalo could be handled by community responders instead of police.
They're popping up across the country. There's over 100 cities that have community responder teams already, and they are immensely successful. Where police exist to address crime, firefighters to stop fires, EMS for medical emergencies, community responders are specifically for health and social needs in the community.
O'Sullivan cites the work of community responders in the city of Eugene, Oregon, where they save $2.2 million in police wages each year and $14 million in emergency room costs. New York State is being asked to step in to save Weinberg Campus. The Senior Care Center in Amherst is slated to close next month, displacing 140 residents. One step in the complex process to save the facility occurred Wednesday when Weinberg CEO Robert Mayer signed off on a plan that would allow Lineage Care Group to serve as a receiver. A group of local elected officials, including Congressman Tim Kennedy, Erie County Executive Mark Poloncarz, and Buffalo Acting Mayor Chris Scanlon, released a joint statement urging Governor Kathy Hochul to intervene. A Buffalo man faces several charges after targeting several people with threats through social media. Police say the posts were made during the early morning hours of Saturday, October 26th, and the suspect was quickly identified. 57-year-old Mark Ferraro was apprehended on the first block of Best Street by officers and detectives. Ferraro was also arrested in early October for allegedly threatening to bomb a Buffalo police building. And New York State is making funds available to private landowners to establish new forests. The Department of Environmental Conservation has $4.5 million to allocate for grants to interested residents who own 5 acres of unforested land. Applicants would work with a forester or qualified natural resource professional to develop their projects. That effort is part of Governor Kathy Hochul's 25 million trees by 2033 initiative, designed to create new forests across New York State to mitigate the impacts of climate change.
You're listening to WBFO. I'm Holly Kirkpatrick. Early voting is underway in New York, and all eyes are on the presidential race. But that's not the only office up for election. There are congressional and some Senate seats on the ballot, as well as local races, which vary depending on where you live. In Genesee County, almost all local seats are unopposed. In fact, of the 15 local offices on the ballot, there are just 2 contested seats, and there's not a single Democratic candidate in the heavily Republican county. I spoke with Howard Owens, publisher of The Batavian, an online news site serving the people of Genesee County. I asked, why are so many local seats uncontested?
In my perception, so I've been covering Genesee County for about 16 years, in my perception, there's always been a low number of Democratic candidates. Democrats have always complained about their difficulty in recruiting candidates to run for office and have made a lot of effort in that regard. I would say over the last several years, particularly since the advent of Trump, kind of the feedback I'm hearing from local Democrats is it's gotten a lot harder to recruit candidates. You know, this is a heavily red county, and there's a lot of support for Trump here. And there's a lot of concern that being a Democratic candidate is going to open you up to a lot of negative reaction from people.
So in general, then, what issues have your readers talking?
I think everybody's concentrated on the presidential race. And, you know, this what people see is the disparity between the two candidates. You know, obviously here there's a lot of support for Trump. Nobody is kind of budging that from that position.
And how about the subject of immigration? You know, at Trump rallies, that's a subject that is frequently raised. Is that being talked about in Genesee County?
Particularly for Trump supporters. I mean, when they talk about Trump, that's one of the first issues they raise is immigration. So, you know, that does seem to be a concern. And it's something of a dividing line even among Republicans here, because so many of our Republican people in this county who are Republican are also in agriculture, and they tend to have a different take on immigration than a lot of other Republicans these days.
In what way?
Well, you know, they've been hurting for a long time for labor. And so they want to see something done that will help restore labor force to agriculture.
And using immigrants in order to do that.
Right. I mean, that's been for what, 40 or 50 years, immigrants have been the primary labor source for farmers all across the country. So it becomes much more difficult to bring in the crop, so to speak, if you don't have experienced workers.
Genesee County sits in New York's 24th congressional district. The race there is between Republican Claudia Tenney, the incumbent, and Democrat David Wagenhauser. Is that race registering at all?
I would say it hasn't really come up at all. I've heard nobody talking about the race. Tenney has made one public campaign-related trip to Genesee County, as far as I know. I mean, there have been nothing publicly released. She may have made, you know, fundraisers that aren't necessarily made public. But her only appearance has been here is when the GOP opened their local campaign headquarters. She was here for that. Otherwise, I haven't seen her campaigning here at all. I haven't seen David campaigning here at all. He may be making appearances that are not being made public, but we've not been made aware of any appearances here.
I spoke with Genesee County Democratic Commissioner Lori Longany on Monday, the third day of early voting, about the early vote turnout in Genesee County. And she said that the first day of early voting was a record turnout. Does that surprise you at all?
Not per se. Our news editor voted that day and reported, you know, she got up, reported there were lines. So that, you know, was surprising to her. To that extent, perhaps it's surprising. We've not kind of seen that before. Observing it over all the years and nothing's changed this year is the two election commissioners always get along very well. They're very cooperative. They're both focused on the same task of ensuring, a free and fair election, that all votes are properly counted and tabulated. And so I'd say one thing, I think, you know, people can have confidence that whatever the results are in Genesee County, they're going to accurately reflect the votes that were cast.
Howard Owens, publisher of The Batavian, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
Holly Kirkpatrick, WBFO News.
After more than 5 years of negotiations with creditors, a proposed deal would see three tobacco giants pay out $32.5 billion to Canadian provinces and to smokers. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the proposal is the result of a court-appointed mediation process.
The proposal was filed recently in an Ontario court. The three companies, JTI McDonald, Rothmans, Benson & Hedges, and Imperial Tobacco, sought creditor protection in Ontario in 2019 after they lost an appeal in a landmark court battle in Quebec. All legal proceedings were placed on hold while the tobacco giants tried to work out a deal with creditors, including plaintiffs in two class action lawsuits and provinces trying to recover the costs of smoking-related health care. It's one of the costliest lawsuits in Canadian history, and some proceedings go back to the 1990s. Bruce Johnson is one of the lawyers for the Quebec plaintiffs in their lawsuit.
When we started this case in 1998, not a single person in the world had received a single penny from a tobacco company in compensation. And as a result of this litigation, tens of thousands of Canadians will receive very significant awards. This has never happened anywhere in the world.
Under the proposed settlement, Canada's provinces and territories would get nearly $25 billion, and more than $4 billion would go to tens of thousands of smokers and their loved ones in Quebec. There would also be $2.5 billion for smokers in other provinces and territories who were diagnosed with lung cancer, throat cancer, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease between March of 2015 and March of 2019. Johnson says many of the class action members have died, but in some cases their successors would be eligible for compensation. Several health care groups, however, have urged the provinces to impose regulations and measures to reduce smoking as part of any deal. And Rob Cunningham of the Canadian Cancer Society says the proposed deal doesn't include policy measures aimed at reducing tobacco use.
It does not go far enough. It's inadequate. In contrast to the United States, when they had a similar settlement, this proposed settlement contains nothing to actually reduce smoking. You know, and smoking is a public health disaster. It's a leading preventable cause of disease and death in Canada, killing 46,000 Canadians. And we need to do everything to reduce smoking caused by tobacco industry behavior.
Money for smokers would begin to roll out fairly soon, but nearly half of the proposed settlement wouldn't start going to the provinces and territories until 2030. Flora Ducas is with the Quebec Coalition for Tobacco Control. She says the positive aspect of the proposal is that victims will begin to get compensation, but the provinces, who are trying to recoup decades of health care costs, will have to wait.
Most of the money that they will see as part of these payments is not on the table. It's not money that currently exists. It will come from future sales. It's based on the revenues that the companies are expected to make on the sale of tobacco products in the years to come, even past 2035.
Ducas also says she's disappointed that governments didn't use their powers to demand tougher measures against smoking. Government lawyers and other stakeholders are still mulling over the 1,400-page proposal, and it could be some time before the package is accepted or turned down. For WBFO News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto on the Canadian Beat.
For WBFO, I'm Dallas Taylor. Buffalo has ghosts. And no, not just the sports-related ones like wide right or no goal. Real ghost. But according to Mason Winfield, when dealing with the paranormal, it's a little bit more than that.
Well, the paranormal, the word has classically meant just something that's outside the mainstream belief system. And it doesn't mean ghosts. It's a very big field. It includes ghosts.
Winfield is an author and researcher that specializes in the paranormal, but he makes it very clear that he is not a ghost hunter.
You'd almost call me an antiquarian in a way, because I'm interested in curious, out-of-the-way stuff. And my specialty is the supernatural and paranormal traditions of the upstate.
I spoke to Winfield during the spooky season to get some of his insight on the ghost haunts of Buffalo. Knowing that ghost walks and haunted tours would be happening, which he does host some of those himself, I found it much safer to talk about those in a studio. And I also found out that with Buffalo's rich history, we have quite a bit of stories to tell.
I think Buffalo's supernatural folklore kind of falls into the patterns we'd expect. I would say I was surprised by how much of it there was. Mm. I mean, we're not a New Orleans. We're not a Savannah. We're not a Charleston. We haven't had these waves of dramatic human history sweeping over us for at least centuries. And, I mean, our Euro-American history goes back about 224 years in the Buffalo area. And that's young. So I was surprised at how much supernatural folklore we have. I mean, it seems like every block in the city has, you can find some kind of a haunted house.
We didn't get into specific stories, but buildings such as the Buffalo Central Terminal and City Hall, places that are known for being haunted, Winfield's extensive research does pick up on patterns of the designs of certain buildings that connected to its haunted reputation.
There are associations that ghost stories at places are associated with a few other patterns. And one of them is anything with a steeple, a tower, or a cupola will tend to get ghost stories. Any American building with one of those. And very often, the steeple, the tower, or the cupola will be the focus of the stories. But also, any hint of occultism about a structure, either having been built with the formulas of mystical architecture or having potential rituals, having mystics and occultists frequent the site, that will tend to produce ghost stories too.
Another site that hits a little more close to home is the Elmwood Village neighborhood. Known for its haunted houses, Winfield says that Buffalo's history and its role in the War of 1812 lends a hand at producing some of those stories.
And North Street is, well, it was an old road that went from the city straight to the waterfront. And not only does it have some classic architecture, which tends to pick up ghost stories, but it was sort of a battle line in the War of 1812. That fearful night in 1813 when the British Army was marching right up it to burn downtown Buffalo. And as we know, battlefields and trauma, they tend to lead to ghost stories, too.
When it comes to understanding Buffalo's haunted history, Winfield believes that what's most essential is the site.
Well, I think our record of supernatural folklore is so in the city is so colorful and so diverse. Everything along the Niagara River, from Buffalo to Fort Niagara, on both sides, at one point or other in those 3 years, was torched. I also think sites that were significant to the First Nations people. And a lot of these places aren't remembered anymore, but these were visionary sites. And if you can track one where it used to be and find the spot, you will very often find people right there experiencing EHE, exceptional human experience.
So whether you want to believe them or not, Winfield says that it's best to just enjoy the folklore for what it is. And just so I can close my eyes at night, I'll just say that the draft in my house is an open window. For WBFO, I'm Dallas Taylor.
Don't forget to like or subscribe so you can help others find this podcast. And if you love it, leave a review too. The WBFO Brief Podcast and the award-winning journalism of WBFO's news team are made possible by our members. Thank you for listening.